Welcome back to Beats Research Radio. My name is Hallie Arnett, and I'm the Canadian Biomaterials Society, Ottawa Student Chapter President. And I'm here today with Dr. Rothstein. He is an assistant professor with the Department of Biochemistry, Microbiology, and Immunology with the University of Ottawa, and the director of the Molecular Imaging Probes Radiochemistry Laboratory at the University of Ottawa Heart Institute. Dr. Rothstein has received Young Investigator Awards from the Society of Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Imaging, as well as the Alzheimer's Drug Discovery Foundation. He has been a co-investigator on project grants from the ADDF and the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Disease Research. The research that's conducted in his lab, the Molecular Imaging Probes and Radiochemistry Laboratory, is directed towards the discovery of radiopharmaceuticals for studying biochemical and pharmaceutical mechanisms in living systems and diagnosis of disease conditions. Specific cardiovascular imaging targets include biomarkers and therapeutic targets for atherosclerosis, arrhythmias, valve disease, and heart failure. In support of these goals, the lab also develops innovative radiochemical methodologies for small molecule radio labeling and bioconjugation with short-lived isotopes such as carbon-11 and fluorine-18. So welcome, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for the kind introduction.
Do you mind telling our listeners a little bit about your background and how you found yourself here at the University of Ottawa Heart Institute?
Sure. Yeah, so my background is actually in chemistry. I was trained doing organic synthesis. That's what I did in my undergrad, and then for grad school, also developing methodologies. And that's really fun work. I still really love that. But I kind of transitioned from that towards applications of some of these methods. So during grad school, I was working a lot on peptides and macrocyclization reactions. And then as part of that, I had the opportunity to do kind of an internship with a pharmaceutical company. And that was part of a collaboration with a Structural Genomics Consortium, which is a worldwide organization seeking to develop novel probes. So that kind of opened my eyes to what chemical methodologies can do. Mm-hmm. And that got me really excited to take reactions that I could develop in the lab, that they would open up whole new spaces for us to use our chemistry to have an impact on health. So I got really excited about these types of applications, both for medicine and for other technologies. And so I decided for a postdoc to pursue one of those. And that took me into the crazy world of radiochemistry and molecular imaging. And the rest kind of just worked out in a way that I managed to secure this position and mm-hmm. get to come back to Canada.
Oh, great. So I understand your laboratory is working on the development of the novel radio tracers to improve understanding of disease and to develop effective treatment methods and also diagnosis. Would you be able to tell us about what a radio tracer is and then also what they do and how you're using these in order to be translational for the clinics?
Yeah, so a radio tracer can be considered just a molecule that we give at a very low dose so that it's very safe for patients, even though there is a radioactive nuclide on there. That allows it to detect it with very high sensitivity. So mm-hmm. we can give a very low dose of a drug to a patient or to a subject, and then we can track where that drug is going within the body and actually what it's binding to.
Okay.
So it's through a series of experiments that we're then able to determine what the molecular target of that drug is, and then we can actually quantify how much of that target is there and what state it's in. So that lets us really study biochemistry within a living system, which is something that we can't really do by other means.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why this is such an important imaging modality. So these are nuclear imaging modalities. The one we work on most is called positron emission tomography. It's just a very sensitive method, and so it's used routinely for diagnosis, especially here at the Heart Institute, but also in many other applications. We can study some fundamental biochemical mechanisms within a human and complex living systems, and we can also use this to develop new therapies, as you mentioned.
Okay.
So, for example, by measuring whether we're actually engaging a specific target that we think is going to modify disease.
Okay. So these radio tracers, would it be ingestible or would it be through like a catheter or injectable?
Yeah, so most often they're given intravenously, but that's not always the case. So nuclear medicine has a long history going back many decades, and there's many different ray traces that have been developed. So many are inhaled, some are given as colloids, as eye drops, and it really depends on what the target we're trying to image is.
Okay.
Most of the ones that we image, especially with PET, because we're working with short-lived isotopes, we tend to give them intravenously so that they're engage the target very rapidly.
And you said they're very sensitive. Why are they very sensitive and able to target these locations in the body so well?
Yeah, that has to do with the physics of the system, which is that the radioactivity, it's one of the reasons what we're concerned about radioactivity is because it can penetrate through materials and through the body. Mm-hmm. So that also means that as opposed to visible light or even near infrared light, that can only penetrate through maybe a few millimeters of tissue, the gamma photons that are emitted from these isotopes, they can penetrate through your body pretty easily. So that means that we're able to detect them externally. Mm-hmm. We don't need to do anything invasive. And also because whereas looking around us, we're bathed in invisible light, mm-hmm. There's much lower levels of gamma radiation in our environment. So that means that we can detect with high sensitivity when there's a photon to be detected. Mm-hmm. It really has to do with some wonderful instruments that engineers and physicists have developed throughout the 20th century, really.
Right. So a little bit about the importance of carbon-11 and fluorine-18 and how they're important for radio labeling and bioconjugation. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, so those are kind of the two radionuclides that my lab focuses on most.
Okay.
And that's for a few reasons. The first is that they have really ideal imaging properties. Mm-hmm. So they give off relatively low energy positrons, so the radiation is fairly low energy, which gives a high resolution image. Mm-hmm. They also don't have a lot of other decay pathways that are going to cause trouble for patients in terms of the amount of radiation they're getting.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, there's, actually two more reasons. Another reason is that these atoms are often found in small molecules and in biomolecules, mm-hmm. which means that most of the drugs we give, the therapeutic drugs as well as the imaging drugs, are made with these atoms involved.
Right.
That means that we can do a direct substitution, we can incorporate them, we know that they're safe, and they're going to behave in expected ways within the body.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, they also have half-lives that are really convenient for clinical use. So for carbon-11, the half-life is 20 minutes, which is quite short.
Mm-hmm.
For fluorine-18, it's about 2 hours, 110 minutes actually. And that means that they're just long enough that we have time to make the isotope, which we do within the heart institute, do some chemistry to make the drug, mm-hmm. and then we can still image it within the patient and observe the processes of the radiotracer distributing and engaging with the target we want, and then washing out. And by not having it last too long within the body, it also means the patient receives a lower dose of radiation.
Right.
So these are really nice ones for both the practical advantages and also the safety advantages.
Okay. So is it 20 minutes from fabrication to, I guess, ingestion or into the body?
Yeah, this is a question that a lot of people ask, and it's actually one that I remember, it was one of the first questions I asked when I started getting interested in this field. And no, the case is that it doesn't have to be that way. So we can make a lot more radioactivity than we need to give in a single dose. That means that you have many half-lives to work with.
Okay.
There tends to be a bit of a guideline for you want to go 3 half-lives at most for your synthesis. But very often, it's just a matter of if we can make enough radioactivity and if that radioactivity is kind of high enough quality.
Mm-hmm.
That we can safely give it to a patient at a later time point. But for example, with a lot of the fluorodeoxyglucose, which is one of the most important radiotracers in PET, it measures glucose metabolism. This radiopharmaceutical is produced centrally in many places. So for example, in Ottawa, we produce it and distribute it around the region. When we're not producing it, we actually ship it in from Hamilton every day.
Oh, okay.
So they're making it early in the morning or late at night the day before. And they're able to ship it to us, and we can use it all day.
Okay.
So it's not a case where we're limited that much by the half-life, mm-hmm. But when we don't have such a large operation, then yes, we want to bring the imaging and the production as close together as possible.
Awesome.
So certainly within the same day, and if we're talking carbon 11, yeah, within a couple hours.
Okay. So how would these be different? They're both important and they're both of interest, but when would you use carbon 11 over fluorine 18?
Yeah, so that has to do with how specifically you want to label a molecule. So, for example, if we want to image, for example, acetate metabolism, which is something we do clinically at the Heart Institute as well, there's no fluorine found in that atom. It's a very small molecule, and we don't want to derivatize it because fluoroacetate happens to be toxic. So, in that case, in many cases, carbon is really a desirable isotope because it's found in so many molecules, and all organic molecules have carbon. With fluorine, definitely the practical advantages are the slightly longer half-life. So when we can incorporate that, we do like to. The chemistry can sometimes be more challenging with fluorine. So very often in my lab, we'll use carbon for early development. It's easy to get the isotope on. We can test a number of molecules. And then when we find one we like, we may try to label it with a fluorine isotope instead.
Very cool. So what do you think one of the main challenges is in the field of radiochemistry and also with radiotracer development? Is there something that is slightly more complicated or makes the process harder?
There's a lot of challenges. It's really like doing drug discovery, but it tends to happen more in academic labs. So I'd say one of the biggest challenges that a lot of labs face is finding a molecule that that engages with a target very specifically within the human body. It always actually amazes me that we have any radiotracers that work well, because the number of targets, the number of things that can happen to this molecule once you give it into a living system is really innumerable. And the fact that we're able to find some that get into the body, get taken up in the right tissue, bind to the right target, and don't bind to so many other things that our entire signal is washed out is really amazing. So that's always been a major challenge. But I think more specifically, there are a lot of challenges now where we're trying to pair diagnostic radiotracers with therapeutic drugs that also have radioisotopes on them. So finding ones that are really going to work both for imaging as well as therapy. And then engaging very low density targets. So for example, with metabolic targets, glucose metabolism, those are present on every cell. They're going to be taken up pretty widely. So that's in some way a bit of a low-hanging fruit, which isn't to say it didn't take quite a bit of development, and it is a huge achievement. But then if we want to find ways to image very low-density targets, so for example, receptors like sigma receptors are very have low expression levels, then we need a very, very high-affinity molecule. And it has to be very high-affinity, very selective, and very specific. To bind only to that receptor in vivo. And that to me is always a great challenge. There used to be, and I think there still are, many challenges with actually getting the radionuclides onto the molecules, but that's seen a lot of attention in the last decade from many excellent labs in North America and Europe and beyond. And so now we have a whole host of more tools, and so that lets us as chemists shift our focus from methods that get the isotopes onto the molecules onto more how do we make a really nice molecule, and what types of molecules can we use to image all sorts of different targets that we never considered before.
Right. So how do you know, so you said that it's hard to have something that's going to be very specific and bind to one thing. How do you know that you're binding to the right location or site of interest?
Yeah, that's always a challenge. So there's a few paradigms that we can use. So in my lab, very often we do saturation studies. So I mentioned earlier that we give the radiotracer an extremely low dose. So this means that the occupancy of our target should be well below 5%. So what we can do then is, if it's safe to, we can dose at a higher level with a non-radioactive compound. And that will saturate up the target. And then if our radiotracer no longer binds with the same kinetics, if it doesn't get taken up into the same tissue, if it washes out much faster, then that gives us a good indication that we're binding to the right target. And you can saturate different targets that way to kind of knock out the different possibilities. Now, that's an infinite approach. You could keep doing that until the cows come home, but we tend to be fairly selective about it, and that can give us a good hint. There are other strategies as well. So instead of knocking out the target, we can upregulate the target and see if binding increases.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, there's an approach in synthetic chemistry that really relates to this, which is that you can never prove that a mechanism exists. You can only disprove exactly. other mechanisms. So that's kind of what we have to do as well. There are all sorts of ways to gather evidence, but ultimately we have to just we have to build up the strongest case we can. And it may be that there are off targets that we're not aware of, but as long as it gives us a useful signal that we can then take into the clinic, then that's something that I think is successful.
In terms of the length of time it takes to create these molecules so that you can then add the carbon-11, the fluorine-18 to them, and then the injection or intravenous mechanism to put into the body, what's the timeline like in terms of starting and then when it gets to the subject or the patient?
Yeah, it's a really fun day. Mm-hmm. So we have a team of radiochemists at the Heart Institute that for the clinic, they do all the support work. So they're going to prepare the day ahead. They're going to know the time of injection, and they're going to work backwards from that to set a schedule.
Okay.
So when we do it in our research studies, we tend to have a large team involved. So there's somebody in charge of making sure that the isotope is being made, bringing it up to our synthetic labs, another mm-hmm. person in charge of synthesis, and then maybe they're also doing the analysis, making sure that it's of the right quality, we made the right thing. And at the same time, they're coordinating with people getting the research subjects ready, so whether it's animals or cells or tissue, prepping that so that we can really stick to a tight timeline and we know that we're going to pull the study off on time. So it really does take a team effort. Mm-hmm. The best way to go is to write out your plan in advance, have good communication, have timelines and checklists, make sure everything is going to go off. There's always going to be problems. There's always going to be delays. But the more structured we can have a study and the more people we can have involved who are communicating well, then it works. So I typically for 418 one, again, you have a bit more flexibility. Mm-hmm. So if things are delayed by half an hour, even an hour, maybe you can still get the study done.
Okay.
But with carbon-11, you really have to be planning down
to the minute?
Like a few minutes. Yeah.
A few minutes. Okay. And how many people would be involved in this process?
So in our lab, it's typically at least, I'd say, 3 if we're making the radiotracer.
Okay.
But they're exciting days also. So
right.
The grad students, even if they're not directly involved in the study, they want to help out in some way. So it's really, you have to have a good team building environment,
okay.
Making sure everybody can work together.
That's great.
And that tends to be one of the most fun things.
Sure you're on time for work that day.
Yeah. And then it's not just, it doesn't end there. Once it's into the patient or into the subject, then we might be doing things like drawing small amounts of blood from them and mm-hmm. analyzing that. And it really, it lasts all day, making sure
okay.
that everything gets pulled off.
And the monitoring after the molecule and isotope are in the body, then would you monitor for a week or a day, a month?
It depends on the isotope. So for fluorine-18 and carbon-11, we tend to image for an hour, maybe a little bit more than an hour, a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
If there are longer-lived isotopes, so there's zirconium-89, which has a half-life of just over 3 days. So for that one, yeah, you can image out for a week or maybe a little bit longer as well.
Okay.
So again, like based on what applications you're looking at, you may want a longer-lived isotope.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just a matter of that's going to come along with higher dosimetry, but that may be fine depending on the population you're looking at.
And monitoring the possible adverse effects of this, would be part of what you do, or would that be something down the road? Or
so there are radiobiologists who specialize in this. It tends to be that we know the levels we're working with are
okay.
pretty safe. But certainly we do monitor and make sure that everybody's recovering well. We're actually, with small animal studies, we're more concerned about anesthesia than we are with the radiation dose. So it can be a stressful experience for them if that's the case. But the radiation itself, we've never seen adverse effects in our lab, and
okay.
Very rarely will you hear about that from an imaging study.
Okay, that's good. And so these tools that you're developing, they're extremely translational in terms of what you're doing in the lab and how that can be used in the clinics. Is there you know, have, do you think about, it's important to think about how what you're developing is going to be translated. So do you find you're really working right off the bat towards that translational ability of your molecules and your radio tracers?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I mean, not every project is aimed towards clinical imaging, but mm-hmm. I'd say that really is where we should be aiming, because that's really the strength of the technology. That's what nuclear imaging and PET can do better than anything else. So for that, we're really fortunate to have engaged clinicians at the Heart Institute. And I think that's essential for anywhere you go. Building those connections and having good relationships with people who tell you what they need in the clinic. And then on the other side, also the biologist. So you know that you're going after a target that's appropriate. So that's actually one of the things I find most gratifying about working in this field, is that I know my role as the chemist. I'm leading development of radio tracers, but I'm working very closely with physicists.
Yes.
I'm working very closely with clinicians. I'm working with biologists. Mm-hmm. It's a really team effort, and it's really gratifying to be able to be that helpful to other people and also learn what they do.
That's very cool. So do you find your research then is extremely interdisciplinary and, you know, working with clinicians and biologists and chemists?
Almost too much so, where I like to bring chemists into my lab because I know how to train them and I think that they can do some really hard stuff that we need. And inevitably, it seems like the chemists want to go and learn biology, they want to go learn physics as well. Mm-hmm. It can be really tempting to go and try to do everything. Which is fun, and it's important that we understand each other, that we're able to communicate on the same levels and really work together that way. But it's also important for us to specialize and do our mm-hmm. thing very, very well. So there's a balance that has to be struck there. Mm-hmm.
And so just briefly, a final question. What's the long-term goal of your research? Is it to push these radio tracers into the clinic?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what I measure myself by is... I know that the research I do is very resource intensive and it's very, it has a lot of potential to help people. So we have to find a way to deliver on that potential. So ultimately, I mean, there are a lot of things we do that are not aimed at clinical translation, and they're still exciting, they're still fun, and we still think they're very important. But ultimately, we know that we have the opportunity to really have a positive impact on human health. And so that's what we have to aim for the entire time.
Well, perfect. Thank you very much for teaching me and our listeners about radio tracers. Thank you to everyone today for tuning in to Beats Research Radio. Before we go, I'd like to thank the University of Ottawa Heart Institute, eLife, the Canadian Biomaterials Society, Ottawa Student Chapter, and the Beats Research Lab and the Department of BMI in the Faculty of Medicine. So we're signing off now, and we'll see you next week.